Good afternoon. I will convene the Education Finance Committee for April 16th. With that, has Representative Ream, have you had a chance to look at the minutes for April 14th?
Yes, Chair Joachim, I have looked at them, and I would like to make a motion to move to approve the amendments.
Representative Ream moves the minutes for April 14th. Are there any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. The minutes for April 14th are adopted. Members, we're going to start out with a presentation on special education evaluation and identification with Jennifer Danielson, the Executive Director of Student Services of South St. Paul Public Schools. Could you please go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed?
Absolutely. Chairs and members of the committee, thank you for having me today. So my name is Jennifer Danielson. I am the Executive Director of Student Services with South St. Paul Public Schools, and I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education. I'm here to talk about special education evaluation process. So content for today is to talk through four main points of the special education evaluation process overall.
Could you pull the
Yes, I will move this closer. Autism criteria, so ASD, autism spectrum disorder criteria in schools, looking at early intensive developmental and behavioral intervention, or EIDBI services, and then how schools and EIDBI providers work together. So for a special education evaluation process, it typically starts in one of two ways, either through a school referral, meaning that the child has their concerns about the student in the school setting, they maybe have done interventions or tried some other things and that's not working. So if someone in the school is suspecting that the child might have a disability, we need to then initiate an evaluation. Or it could be every 3 years, we at least need a reevaluation to take a look at continued eligibility. The other common way is through a parent or guardian referral. So this could be that a parent has a concern about their child and they want to be tested in a certain area, or sometimes a child may receive a diagnosis or something from a medical provider, and then the parent requests a special education evaluation to look at eligibility. Overall, regardless of how the child concern comes forward or the student's concern comes forward, we follow the same kind of process and timeline. So the first thing is that a team gathers the information about the areas of concern. Are there concerns of academics, social emotional behavior, motor skills, adaptive, lots of different areas we take a look at. If the team then decides to proceed to look at whether the child would qualify for special education services, the school team then works on putting together an evaluation plan that would outline all of the areas that we are going to assess at school, and as well as all of the individual tools that we are going to do. Are we going to do direct testing, observations, gather parent interview information? We then send that to the parent, and the parent must provide their explicit consent for an initial evaluation. So they have to sign to say that they agree with that evaluation before we can start that evaluation. Once we get that, we then have 30 school days. Minnesota says 30 school days, federal says 60 calendar days, to complete that evaluation report. So within that 30-day window, we are doing all of the things we said that we would do on that evaluation plan, and then we provide an evaluation report to the parent no later than 30 school days. If the student qualifies, we then look to develop the IEP to see what that student will need for their individualized education program. Overall, the special education evaluation process says a couple of different things. These are some of the highlights. It has to be a multidisciplinary team. It has to be assessments that are administered by people that are trained. So my background is a school psychologist, so I have training to do intellectual assessments, for example. Special education teachers don't have that training, so they do more of the academic pieces typically, or some observations. So we need to make sure that any testing that we're given is being done by appropriately licensed people. We have to consider evaluations in all areas of concern, so we can't just kind of narrow in and say, we only really want to look at this area. We need to make sure that we're looking at all suspected areas of disability. And then it has to be a comprehensive evaluation, so we can't just make a decision based on one assessment or one tool. We have to have a variety of tools that we are using as a multidisciplinary team to look at eligibility. We gather all of that information from the evaluation plan, and then we take a look at whether the student meets entrance criteria and shows a need for specially designed instruction in one of these 13 categories. So these are the categories that we use. They're largely federal as well, but there are some changes in Minnesota. For example, other health disabilities, what we call it in Minnesota, Other health impairment is what the federal regulations say for it. Same general idea, but these are at least one of these categories a student needs to meet criteria and show a need. And we look at autism spectrum disorder criteria specifically in schools. With this, it all means that it again has to be that multidisciplinary team. So meaning it has parents, there are often a school psychologist, sometimes there's a speech language pathologist, it might be an occupational therapist, might be an adapted PsyEd teacher, a general education teacher, parents, the student, depending on their age. And we have to gather that information from a variety of sources and settings. So we can't just be getting information from one teacher or from one setting. We have to look at across areas. And then the team membership has to include someone with expertise in the area of autism. Sometimes this is the school psychologist, oftentimes it is. It also requires that there is a teacher that is licensed in ASD that is part of the evaluation team and IEP team. So this can get really technical, but this is the actual criteria that we use for autism. I'm going to kind of try to keep it higher level here. But what we do is in the autism criteria in the schools, we look at two parts. We look at Part A and Part B. So in Part A, a student has to show a qualitative impairment of reciprocal social interactions by seeing that at least two of these indicators here are checked based on that evaluation plan and the data that we gathered. So they have to show areas of social interaction, and then they also have to show concerns in either communication or in stereotyped patterns of behavior. So same thing. So social interaction is the big one, and then it is communication or repetitive behaviors for the other part of the criteria. With that, we have to make that those determinations of what boxes they check in those other ones based on at least two of these things. So oftentimes schools are doing more than this. We're often doing some autism checklists, interviews with parents. We're doing a functional behavior assessment to really look and see what are those triggers for students and what are those settings and what are those triggers. We look at informal standardized testing. We look at intellectual testing, a variety of those pieces. And then Part B of the criteria is that we have to say that the autism adversely affects the pupil's performance in school. So we have to show that they have present levels of need and what their performance is and their educational needs in all of those areas, so that social communication, interaction, and repetitive behaviors. We have to look at all potential areas of disability and concern. We have to have at least two observations in at least two different settings on two different days. And we have to have a summary of their history and their behavior patterns. So what does their development look like and what's kind of that pattern of behavior? So teams that are multidisciplinary looking at that to review the data, the school psychs often lead this, in my experience, lead this process and help teams kind of make sense of the data, but it is a multidisciplinary team. No one person makes a decision of whether a student qualifies for a service or not. An important thing to note here, too, is that autism criteria in schools, we do not provide diagnoses in schools. So if we qualify a student under the IDEA category of ASD, that is not the same as providing them a diagnosis of autism. It is a school eligibility category, and it simply allows them access to special education services. So it's similar criteria in medical and in schools, but it is not the same, and it's not a diagnosis. And then a student does not need a diagnosis from a medical provider in order to qualify under autism in the school. So it goes both ways. Just because they have a diagnosis doesn't mean they automatically qualify. And because they don't have a diagnosis doesn't mean that they don't qualify. So now when we look at EIDBI services, the Early Intensive Developmental and Behavioral Intervention Services, so ultimately, schools do not have a role in determining qualification for EIDBI services. That is something that is done completely outside of the school setting. And we also do not have a financial responsibility for those EIDBI services. So from the DHS website, this is directly quoted from there, that it's really a medically necessary service that's determined outside of the school process. So we might provide a copy of an IEP or a copy of an evaluation report if the parent requests that, but we don't have any role in determining whether a student qualifies for EIDBI. Another visual here that I believe was from DHS or MDE, I can't exactly remember, but the reference is there, is that school, again, has no financial responsibility for those EIDBI services. Schools operate under IDEA and Minnesota state law, and then EIDBI Federate is under Minnesota Medicaid program and is a medically necessary service. So some similarities, but also some differences. So then when we look at how schools and EIDBI interact, We are obligated as schools to provide a free and appropriate public education, FAPE, to all of our students. And oftentimes, EIDBI are not considered school. They don't have a licensed special education teacher on staff or staff that are educators in their programs, in my experience. And right now, just like IEPs are individualized and there are unique needs for every student that I can think of in my district, it's unique circumstances for EIDBI as well. Some students might receive 20 hours a week of EIDBI, some might receive 40 hours. So how we provide programming and supports for that looks different for each student and each individual situation. I've had students that have very minimal service at school receive EIDBI services, and I've had students that receive pretty significant services at school also receive EIDBI services. And then special education directors, we continue to seek clarification from MDE regarding the requirements of this. More and more EIDBI providers are kind of popping up. And this was recently a topic at a director's meeting that we have where MDE has indicated that they're working on these answers to some of these questions, not all of these questions. These aren't the only questions, but these are some of those main ones of like, what is that responsibility of the school district when parents choose to place with EIDBI? And what happens if they want to solely do that and not provide school? What are our obligations to still make sure that a student is receiving a free and appropriate public education? So in closing with this, we are really looking forward to having clear, timely guidance on our questions that we have, because this is becoming more and more of a concern for us with more and more popping up or more and more unique situations. And then without that guidance, implementation varies. So it is different district to district. It is different school to school with that, because we're not quite sure exactly what the guidance is or what we are supposed to do or what's the correct thing to do. So we're just hoping that the sooner that we get that guidance, then we'll lead to less confusion and uneven implementation for our students. Just want to thank you for your time, and I am happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you so much, Executive Director Danielson. With all the talk we've had about special education in this committee, I just wanted folks to understand the lengths you go to put together an IEP. I'll open it up for questions. First, I have Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. This is really a helpful presentation. So I have two questions. One of them is, so what I'm hearing you say is that there can be a situation where a student is actually missing like school time or missing instructional time to go to these services. Is there any kind of documentation, or like, do we have any laws around that? And are there other circumstances where there are procedures around students missing school for medical needs? That's my first question.
So, Executive Director.
Yes, Chair and Sensenmura. There is not necessarily documentation. So it's similar right now, I would say, to if a student is missing for a doctor's appointment. We often excuse those absences, and I would say in my experience we are excusing if families are attending EIDBI services. But I do have some students that might only come to school for like 3 hours a day, and then they go to those providers the rest of the day for that, or some students that are attending a majority of their day or all of their day there. But there's not anything that we necessarily require right now.
Representative Sensenmura.
And so then follow up that, is that being documented in the IEP in any way? And I would guess there might be situations where then that is conflicting with an IEP goal or stated service. And so can you kind of explain how that works?
Executive Director Danielson.
Yeah, Chair and Representative Sensenmura. That is one of the big questions that we have with the department right now. Right now, I would say most directors are leaning towards we're not putting that in the IEP because we don't believe that necessarily is needed for FAPE for the student, right, to access the free and appropriate public education. So that is more like a parent is choosing those services. And we're not saying as a school district, in my situation, I haven't had it where we are saying that child needs that service in order to access the free and appropriate public education. We're saying they can receive those services and we can provide that support at school. So we're often not changing their IEP. With that, we are sometimes putting it in like a prior written notice is what we send to parents for their consent, where we will say the parent is choosing this service, which may mean that they are missing out on school services then to receive that parent chosen service.
Representative Sensenmura, follow up?
Yeah, and then are you, I guess I'll just combine these two questions. So when you are hearing from parents, is there a common reason why you are hearing that parents are wanting to take their student out of the school building to go to this service? And then my second question is, I think we've heard a lot about EIDBI specifically in Minnesota. Is this a Minnesota-specific thing, or is this something that's happening in other states as well?
Executive Director.
Yes, Chair, Representative. I don't know if it's outside of Minnesota, so I'll answer that one first. For the other one, I would say it's all over the place of what I've heard from parents. Sometimes it's really early intervention, so it is students that are going, instead of coming to preschool special education or coming to preschool, they're doing the EIDBI services instead. But it's becoming more common that it's less of that at early childhood age, and it's kind of throughout. And we have students that they receive minimal services at school, and they're getting these outside services. And other, most of the students, I would say, in my experience, are students that are in more intensive, like center-based programming in special education settings for a majority of their day, but not always. It does seem more of early childhood age, but not exclusively.
Representative Spencer Marini.
Yeah, I'll just wrap up with a comment. I mean, I'm really glad that we're having this presentation. I think just learning more, I didn't really understand until recently kind of the lack of licensing for these, and so it does concern me that there could be a written IEP that has stated goals and stated services, and then, you know, a student could be missing so much instructional time that they're actually not able to fulfill that, and are filling, you know, filling that time with what feels just kind of like a very, to me, kind of unclear exactly what is happening there. So I'm glad that we're, even though this is not something that is paid for out of the K-12 budget, I'm glad that we're bringing in this conversation, because it does seem like there's right for maybe more oversight. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sensmer. Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. My question is basically on the graph that you're presenting. With the increases, you know, there's different, so for example, autism, the need of the services increased 36%, but the costs increased 59%. And then I look at some that they're going opposite. They're going down, so there's less need, but I'm not seeing the same reflection on the cost. If you could answer, why do you think that is happening?
Executive Director Danielson, to the best of your ability.
Yes, thanks, Chair and Representative Altura. The graph is not my graph, so I don't know exactly what you're looking at that wasn't in my presentation with it, so I'm not sure on that, but.
I'm sorry.
Oh, you're all right.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to just finish, but okay, sorry. Let me just explain. So we have numbers that show like the services for autism have increased 36%, you know, but the output of dollars is at 59%. So for something like that, I guess my main concern is that, you know, what we're looking at across the state is we have seen a lot of different, our dollars not going where we need them, right? So we hear from the schools all the time, special education is very important, special education's costing our schools a lot of money, it's not always covered. And yet what we're seeing statewide in other programs, so for example, the EIDBI, the autism report that came out, it was $700 million that was unaccounted for, that was looking for that. And my point is that, members, as we are seeing fraud happen in other programs, there's a real cost. We're looking at Governor Walz. His proposal is a $50 million reduction to special ed, but we're seeing other areas of the state that we're not using our dollars wisely.
Thank you, Representative Altendorf.
Madam Chair, just wondering what graph.
Okay, thank you, Representative Sensenmayer. I think the confusion is this was a part of a hearing piece that Representative Chair Carisha was going to have, and it had other items in it that I think Representative Altendorf is looking at. So I'm sorry, Executive Director Danielson, your presentation did not have a graph. Representative Altendorf, your question might be better directed at the agency when we have them up before us. So with that, is there any other questions? Co-Chair Carisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Danielson, for your presentation. So a couple of things that I'm curious about is, as you're working through this and you're doing your job on a daily basis, what clarifications do you need from MDE that would help you move forward in some of the choke points you're running into?
Yeah, I think I'm going to just go back a couple of slides. Some of it is the answer to these questions here of just really what our role is. So when a parent chooses to have their child attend, Chair and members, a parent chooses their child to attend these services and therefore they're missing out on service at school, of like, what is our obligation? do we need to be amending the IEP to say, okay, we know the parent is taking their child out of school every 2 hours, so let's, or for 2 hours every day, let's change the goals, let's change the services, even though we think the child needs to be at school full time. So really looking at that clarification of what is our expectation in our role. And we know that students miss out on services then sometimes. That might mean that they might miss their speech services or their occupational therapy services. And what requirements do we have as a school district? We do that. Or when parents choose to pull their child fully and they're getting EIDBI services for 40 hours a week, and we know that that's not a school setting, are we obligated as school districts then to offer additional school time outside of that? What does that look like? So really trying to get into some of those details of, like, what are our obligations in terms of providing a free and appropriate public education.
Co-Chair Cresha.
Thank you. And so as you're seeking these clarifications, and certainly if MDE wants to weigh in, what's the holdup on getting that? Are the conversations not happening? Are people talking past each other versus talking to them? What is it that you need to get past this issue?
Yeah, Executive Director.
Chair Cresha. And you came. MDE has indicated to us in our February directors meeting recently that they are working with their legal on identifying. So trying to kind of figure out, like, are these programs considered care and treatment, for example? And then what does this look like? And so I think it's kind of in that figuring out that legal piece of things. But I do know that MACE and MDE are regularly communicating too about these pieces. So I think it might be in just some of that legal definition, but the department can certainly speak to that as well.
Co-Chair Cresha.
Sure. I don't know if Mr. Uni would like to come up with. Here's my question. Is this a legal liability? Is this what's hanging it up? Is who's going to accept the liability? Is that what we're worried about?
Do you want to have that answered now, or should we wait until
I can wait as well. I didn't know if they. Yeah, that's fine. So, and then just one other thing, if I could. Thank you. Is there anything from the legislature, is there anything that we should, that you should see come out of here in the next session or this session that would help you with what you're trying to do? I mean, I'm sure there's situations where, you know, take a family or a situation where, like, if we could have just done this. What are examples of some of those that you're looking for?
Executive Director Danielson.
Chair Cresha. I don't think anything legislatively right now that I think the department is working on just those answers on the pieces, and I tend to think of, like, more legislation isn't always a great thing with things for schools.
Love that.
Sometimes it is, sometimes we need that, but I can't think of anything directly right now with it. But I think it's more of just that clarification of the legislation right now that's out there of what does this really look like. Is this care and treatment? And I think that's probably one of the big questions. If this is considered care and treatment, then we already have care and treatment mm-hmm. kind of legislation that we can then figure out what that fits in. Or if this isn't care and treatment, then what is it and where does that fall? Does it fall somewhere else legally, or do we need additional legislation on that?
Thank you.
Co-Chair Cresha. We might have to use our power to convene to get this straightened out. I'm glad that you had this in your presentation and that we were able to have you to come back. It's helpful to start the conversation going. Thank you. I don't see any other questions, so actually I'm going to take a moment, because we always get crushed at the end, to just, since this is our last meeting, to thank our absolutely incredible nonpartisan staff, who was always smarter than we are, Tim Strom, Christina Pera, and Salve Beckel, to thank our partisan staff, our CAs, the CLAs, Janelle Volka, and Isabel, who's Isabel Anderson, who's been filling in, and our and Isaac, and then our researchers, sorry, Lauren Seba and Isaac Pillion, and then of course our wonderful CAs in Polly Strickbenek and Jody Withers, and then also the pages that have been with us, Natalia Wavra and Natalie Warva, and then Cayenne Corder, and then with that too, I would like to thank Co-Chair Cresha. This is our last meeting, our hearing, and I got to know you a bit better over the years, especially I still think back of the time we did new member orientation together. I learned a lot from you then, and I continue to, and I appreciate our working relationship and the care that you have for our students across the state. Last year was tough, but I appreciated the working relationship we built, and we got through it. So I just want you to know that you've really made an impact on schools across the state and that you're going to be missed. And Representative Green has something to say, too.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Chair. Yeah, we brought brownies as a, for you. I mean, not all the brownies are for you, but they are to be shared. And then also, I want to recognize to Chair Bennett from Education Policy. We did not bring brownies on the last day of your meeting, but I just want to say, from a new member, I have learned a tremendous amount from both of you and your leadership, and really working with intention for students, and that's been very clear in how you guys do your work. So thank you.
All right. With that, while everybody has their brownies and getting sugared up.
Now you're going to have to give me a couple minutes.
Why don't we do that now before we all get bogged down? Co-Chair Grisha.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the kindness. What I would, and what Chair Joachim has said, and off the record, Cheryl, we've gotten to know each other, work through a lot of things. But what I would also add, and this is a challenge I put out to all the members that are going to be back and come back, please take the bipartisan spirit that has come out of education finance. It's okay to have dust-ups. It's okay to have our policies. But take that and keep that as the standard. We need that. I've been through many other committees, and I see things where that gets dropped. There's more agreement here and amongst our schools and how we educate than there is disagreement. We sometimes have to deal with the technicalities of what happens and so forth. You know, before this meeting, full disclosure, I could sit down with the department, Mr. Uni. Him and I have a lot of respect, and I could say, we're going to talk about this. We know we're going to get there. It's okay. So thank you. That has been fostered by our communications, and I think that there's a great group here that can take that forward. So thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Krisha. With that, I'm going to hand the gavel over to Vice Chair Clardy while I move up to the testifiers desk for House File 4893.
So our next agenda item is House File 4893, and Chair Joachim, would you like to move House File 4893 before the committee with the intention to refer it to the Committee on Ways and Means?
Yes, thank you, Chair Clardy.
Okay. I also see that you have a DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape of the that the author wishes. Would you like to move the DE1 amendment?
Yes, Chair Clardy, I'd like to move the DE1.
Great. So I'll suggest that we adopt the DE1. To get the bill in the shape that the author intends. Any questions? Seeing none, Chair Joachim renews her motion to adopt the DE1 amendment. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. I mean, aye. Okay. I'm in favor of this one. Okay, so the motion prevails, and you may present your the amendment as adopted, and you may present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Clardy and members. We are here at our last committee meeting of the session. In February, we started out with a discussion revolving around our students' school safety. And it is about time that we work together to get a meaningful legislation passed to make our schools safer. Without a budget target, we need a practical and effective approach. Our leadership has not set those targets and have told us that if we want to make additional investments in the K-12 area, we would need to find that money within our own budget cycle, our budget area. Last year, we made really tough decisions together to meet our cut target in order to pass an education budget bill out, and I do not want our schools to have to endure more of the same. As we crafted this bill, we did not see the NLX funding in the transportation arena as a piggy bank to be raided, and our team did not want to take your approach of shifting money away from a funding stream that has added essential school counselors, social workers, psychologists, and nurses into our schools. What you see in House File 4893 is an efficient and effective layered approach to school safety. Earlier this session, we had Dr. Peterson and Dr. Densley here from the Violence Prevention Project Research Center to prevent evidence-based ways to stop school shootings. They talked about shooters as insiders, with 57% of them being current students and 23% former students. They explained that these shooters are in crisis, with over 80% of them showing signs like depression, mood swings, agitation, and isolation before they attack. That these young adults see the shooting as a final act, that they study other shooters, and almost always leak their plans to someone. In fact, 90% of them tell someone their plans before they act. And finally, that this is about the weapons that they use. 59% that are borrowed or stolen from family or others. And those are always guns. Dr. Peterson and Dr. Densley say that all these facts lead to the need for a layered approach to prevention. Since the perpetrators are insiders, we must think beyond locked doors and drills. We need licensed staff and trusted adults in our school buildings to understand the signs and are trained in crisis intervention. Since the shooters see their act as a final one, we need to invest in suicide prevention and not punishment for the change in their behavior. Suspension leads to isolation and exacerbates the situation. The first layer in building a network of trusted adults in our schools is, which is what we did in the 2023 budget cycle when we created the Student Support Personnel Aid funding stream. While we had to slow down the growth of SSPA last session, we begin to increase it in Section 4 of this bill. We used just over $4 million in one-time funding to go from the $30.05 per pupil in 26 to $34.32 in fiscal year 27, getting to that increased dollar amount a year faster. And it is my hope that when we set the two-year budget cycle next session, we can increase that amount again. Evidence also shows the importance of having a school safety plan that goes beyond doors and drills, as well as an anonymous threat reporting system to allow students, staff, and administrators to coordinate reports of concerning behavior. Unlike the bill we heard on Tuesday, House File 4893 does not merely suggest a school adopt these important systems, but requires them to do so. I'm going to briefly have Representative Ray Brower and Ream discuss Sections 1, 2, and 3 of the bill that contain the language around school safety plans and anonymous threat reporting systems, but I want to first preface that with the fact that I know Representative Curran and Representative Nadeau also worked on language, and I have spoken with the BCA and the School Safety Center, and they'd like to see some changes in this to make it a little bit more doable, and we'll be continuing those conversations. But I would like to have Representative Ray Rauer and then Representative Ream discuss that portion briefly.
Representative Ray Rauer.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. So anonymous threat reporting systems, or ATRS, are fundamental to preventing the next tragedy. As legislators, we have to balance the rights of all Minnesotans. And simply put, our students have the right to be safe at school and to stay alive. As legislators, it's our duty to take action to prevent the next tragedy from happening. A few weeks ago, as Chair Joachim has talked about, we had the Violence Prevention Project come to this committee and share their in-depth research with us at this committee hearing. Four mass school shootings, which is four or more students killed, shooters are insiders. 80% are insiders. So hardening schools alone is not an answer, because most shooters have already been through those drills and know the ways around them. Shooters are in crisis. Over 80% show signs before they attack, and over 94% tell someone else. We need to advance sensible, evidence-based violence prevention strategies. What we know from Sandy Hook Promise is that anonymous threat reporting systems, along with behavioral threat assessment teams, work to get students the help they need before it's a crisis or a tragedy. They prevent suicides, they prevent mass shootings. Schools do face enormous challenges today, and funding is limited. So because of this, my bill language that is in this bill provides school districts a choice. They must either use and promote the Department of Public Safety's statewide anonymous threat reporting system or implement their own local system. While gun violence prevention efforts seem to remain controversial within the Capitol, an entire generation of young Americans are growing up preparing for active shooters in their schools. We must do more to ensure no more gun violence in our schools. So thank you so much, Chair Joachim, for this bill and for including the language on anonymous threat reporting systems and requiring every school district to utilize one. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ray Rauer. Representative Ream.
Thank you, Chairs. I think I would echo what Representative Ray Rauer had said. I will say that I serve on the Public Safety Committee, And for me, it's really disappointing that we didn't pass a law to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. I think that's the first thing we needed to do. And short of that, you know, I'm disappointed that we couldn't get that done. And I'm hoping we will still continue that conversation and we will work on this ban, because that's what the parents, that's what the students want. They want these weapons of wars out of our schools, off of our streets. Knowing that, we do know that gun laws work. We had the red flag laws. When they were passed, right away we saw that lives were saved. Universal background checks, when we passed that, we saw that lives were saved. I really hope we can continue the conversation on how we protect our schools, and it's not just about hardening our schools. You know, there's only so much funds that we have, and the need is so great. We need to put it into our students, into our school personnel, not into hardening our schools, because that would, it'd be, it's just not feasible for us to harden our schools the way we would need to keep our schools safe from these weapons of war. With that said, we know the threats to our schools are coming from former students. That our kids are on the front lines there. They hear from other kids what's happening online, in the classroom. And so I think it's really important that we have students who have good connections with their teachers, and we have a way for them to report these threats anonymously. The BCA has a school safety center where we have an anonymous tip line. That tip line is available not only to public schools but to non-public schools. So I think having a system, having schools mandated to have something in place is the way we need to go. I know what the Representative Nadeau's bill, it says that they encourage schools to have a threat reporting system. I think it needs to be mandated. I think we need to take serious action. And so I like the stronger language that is in my bill, and I'm glad to see it included in Chair Joachim's. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Riedemann. We also, in Section 2, talk about school safety plans. And I got some feedback from the BCA, especially along the line 2.20, that they don't want it to just say human caused safety incidents, because there's many safety incidents that happen in our schools, and it has to be kind of an inclusive plan. Like I said, that we will be working with the BCA to get this language right, that it's doable. They also need a little bit more time to do a model plan. And we do give some time for our districts to adopt these, but want them to get started as soon as they can, because it's just too important. We'll have a budget cycle in between now to when these have to be adopted, so hopefully we can help with some more funding, especially at the School Safety Center. And then with that, I will go to the final, but last but very integral layer of school safety, and is what that's what we do about the weapons used in school shootings. There's, as Representative Reem said, there are sensible gun violence provisions that have been heard in public safety and are hopefully going to be moving this year somewhere, namely on the ban on high-capacity magazines and assault rifles. But contrary to some beliefs, the Education Committee does have a place in the discussion of gun violence in our schools and communities. One of those is an evidence-based approach that Dr. Peterson and Dr. Densley suggest, which is safe storage of guns, especially on our school grounds. So Representative Green will talk about her bill that's in Section 5.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative Joachim, for this opportunity to talk about this part of the bill. School safety can be defined in a thousand ways and demands a comprehensive approach. In addition to critical services and supports for students, we also need to consider any other places where student safety is vulnerable. This bill is about one thing: securing firearms on school grounds and where students are. This is really an opportunity for us to use our ability and our responsibility to be proactive and to work to prevent avoidable tragedies on school grounds. So, this bill has two big elements. One, in vehicles. Current law just isn't enough. We need more than a law that says firearms need to be out of sight, but firearms need to be unloaded and locked up so that we take away access, whether it's intentional or accidental. This is a very reasonable ask of responsible gun owners. The second is within school facilities. Currently in law, principals have the authority to allow anyone to carry a firearm inside a school building with their permission. But what this does is it creates a situation where it is unknown who is and who isn't carrying a deadly weapon. Teachers wouldn't know. Students wouldn't know. Trained school security officers wouldn't necessarily know. This creates a potentially dangerous environment that is 100% avoidable. Principals agree. Both elementary and secondary, if you look in your packets, both associations sent a letter of support in this. Superintendents do too. If you'll look, we have a letter from the Superintendent and School Administrator Association as well. The other piece of this bill, of this work, is we've been working with Hennepin County Sheriff Dewana Witt. And I want to read just a piece of the letter that she submitted. This House file establishes uniform firearm storage requirements on school property. This is a clear, practical proposal that will benefit both schools and law enforcement. By creating consistent expectations statewide, the bill makes compliance easier for the public and enforcement more consistent and effective. And I want to also mention, I really appreciate conversations I've had with Representative DePell as well about non-public schools. And this bill is in no way and wants to create a space where puts any kind of roadblocks up for security for non-public schools. And so you'll hear from a testifier in a little bit. We're working on an amendment, but we want to make sure that we get to a place that there's no unintentional consequences of this bill with non-public schools and not them not being able to keep their students safe with trained security officers. So.
Thank you, Representative Green. Chair Joachim, any further comments before we go to testifiers?
No, I'll just do a closing after if you want to go to testifiers.
Wonderful. I'm going to call the next two testifiers up. And because they're minors, I'm going to just use their first names. But if they choose to use their first and last name at the testifier table, they can do that as well. So I'm calling Anushka up and LV. Please state your name for the record.
Hi, my name's Anushka.
Hello, my name is Alvi.
Anushka, would you begin?
My name is Anushka, and I'm a senior at Edina High School testifying in support of HF 4893. As a student, I know that gun violence and the possibility of a shooting has a direct impact on students' well-being and ability to learn. Research shows that rising rates of depression and anxiety in students is linked to a rise in school shootings. In school, we should be able to focus on our tests and extracurriculars, not worry about never seeing our loved ones again. Right now, firearms are stolen out of vehicles every 9 minutes in the U.S., more than 350,000 annually. In addition, over half of all suicide deaths in the U.S. occur with a firearm. A few months ago in North Carolina, a student shot and killed themselves outside their school after accessing an unsecured firearm in a car in the parking lot. Furthermore, firearms stored in vehicles on school property are not consistently secured. A recent survey reported that 27% of firearm owners stored a gun in their vehicle, of which 22% reported at least some unsecured storage. This bill is about securing firearms on school grounds. The bill would require that those firearms be unloaded, locked in a secure container designed to prevent tampering, and placed in a locked trunk. If there is no trunk, they must at least be kept out of plain sight. It also extends these same protections to Minnesota State High School League events, even when they take place off school grounds, like games at local arenas. Many families across our state safely own firearms for hunting, sports, or protection. Safe storage is not about taking away that ability, rather about making sure that responsibility continues when firearms are not in use, especially in vehicles on school property where young people may be present. This bill reflects values that many gun owners already practice. If you want to best protect students, you can absolutely do so by creating guardrails for responsible gun ownership through safe storage. Vote yes to protect our students. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Alvi?
Hello, I'm Alvi, and I'm also a senior at Edina High School testifying for HF 4893. My parents immigrated to this country primarily for my education, and now they have to contend with that decision after each major school shooting, after enunciation that one day I may not return home when I go to school. That's not normal. When I talk to others in student unions about how to improve our education, our conversations instead devolve into how to stay safe in case the worst happens. That's not normal. Since the time that I was in middle school, the leading cause for death for teens has been firearms. This has become my normal, and we need preemptive bills to change this reality. Safe storage is an essential start. We know that there's a clear correlation between safe storage laws and reduction in gun violence. In states with safe storage laws, gun-related homicides have fallen by over 19.4%, and general gun-related deaths and injuries have fallen by over 10%. Conversely, states with weak safe storage laws face a nearly 18 times increase in gun theft. Minnesota lags behind more than 10 other states in terms of safe storage. Furthermore, in addition to improving safety, this bill also provides needed clarity for school districts. Currently, principals can approve any individual to carry a firearm onto school property. This bill removes those exceptions because it's a burden that the Minnesota Secondary Principals Associations and other administrators, like the Minnesota Superintendents Association, have explicitly stated they do not want. It's an enormous liability, and there's no documentation of which individuals have received these permissions across the state. That means we don't know who is allowed to have guns on school property. It's ridiculous to risk student lives for these unmarked exceptions. Lastly, this bill also takes into account the trained and identified forms of school security, like SRO officers, so they can continue performing their school duties. Please vote yes for our lives and our safety.
Thank you, Elvi, and thank you, Anoush. Anoushka. And our next testimony is coming from Caitlin Schneider. And Ann Weiss can come up as well.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Caitlin Snyder. I'm speaking on behalf of Education Minnesota and our 84,000 educators across the state. And on this bill, I'm also speaking formally as the Minnesota School Counselors Association. Something that I think is important to recognize is that our membership includes chemical dependency officers. It includes school counselors, school social workers, school psychologists, and school nurses. I'm here today speaking on behalf of the labor union, but I do not feel the need to belabor the point about how important, thank you, how important these relationships are for our students. I think in a perfect world with unlimited money and a full hiring potential, I think we'd all like to see more of these personnel in our schools. I think this is an excellent use of one-time money. I think from my calculations, this would be about $3 or $4 million to increase funding for our student support personnel. And one thing I want to note, as you can see in the bill language, this would move the current student support personnel aid from $30 to $34 per student. It's about a 10% increase. And the way that our non-public guidance counseling services is calculated, it's based on the actual spend that happens at public schools. So as public school spending on guidance counselors and school counselors increases, it also increases the amount of money that's available to our non-public schools. Right now, that's $371 a student. So this is a great approach to address school safety, both at our public schools and our non-public schools, through existing mechanisms. This is a wonderful idea. I hope as we move forward in session and we get the opportunity to work with the other chamber, that this is kept visible and part of the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schneider. Ms. Weiss?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Weiss, Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Independent Schools, also known as MAISE. We represent 17 schools and 10,000 students across our state. I would like to just briefly highlight two concerns with Section 5 of this bill as it relates to private schools. First, the language as written limits who schools can engage to support safety on their campuses. In practice, it would restrict schools to relying on school resource officers or off-duty law enforcement. And while those partnerships are valued, it feels like there's simply not enough available personnel to meet the needs of all of our schools. Secondly, lines 8.7 and through 8.9 remove the authority of school leaders to make decisions about safety on their own campuses. In private schools, there is no district-level structure to absorb that responsibility. School heads and principals are directly responsible for ensuring the safety of their students and staff. Removing that authority creates both operational and accountability challenges for private schools. Please know that we have had conversations with Chair Youakim's staff on these concerns, as well as chief author of this language, Representative Green, and we understand that the impacts of this proposal are not intentional and greatly appreciate their desire to find language that addresses these concerns. If this bill moves along the legislative process, we hope to find a consensus language which preserves flexibility and allows private school leaders to make appropriate site-based decisions to ensure safety.
Thank you for your testimony, Executive Director. And our final testifier here, and then we have one remotely, is Alexandria Fitzsimmons.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Senior Policy Director with Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. We research, develop, and advocate for policies and programs that improve the health and well-being of Minnesota children. Policies that prevent violence and create pathways for early intervention are essential to protecting the well-being of Minnesota children. House File 4893, as amended, represents a thoughtful, flexible, and comprehensive path toward that bipartisan goal. Children carry backpacks to school every day. They carry library books, folders, homework, a snack, maybe a crumpled up permission slip, things they need for the day ahead and the futures they are building through play, friendships, and learning. Children should not be carrying fear, and yet too many of our children do. We all carry with us the children and families of Annunciation and the stories they courageously and selflessly shared in our capital, in their homes, and throughout our state. We also carry with us the Red Lake, Ricori, and Crystal Ray communities. Ensuring every Minnesota child is safe is a responsibility we all share, and it is a responsibility that demands action this session to build and sustain the safety every child deserves. This bill is a critical part of a comprehensive gun violence prevention strategy, and it's based on a bipartisan understanding that prevention must be layered, evidence-based, and rooted in the realities of children's lives. First, this bill requires every school district and charter school to adopt an evidence-based school safety plan aligned with a model developed by the School Safety Center and integrated into crisis management policies. That matters. Research consistently shows that the most effective school safety efforts are not reactive. They are coordinated, evidence-informed, and focused on preventing harm before it occurs. Plans grounded in evidence help schools move beyond drills and toward real prevention. Second, this bill requires schools to implement or actively promote an anonymous threat reporting system, either locally or through the statewide system. We know that in the majority of school violence matters, warning signs are present. And as you've heard again today, they're often observed by peers. And research from the Violence Prevention Project examining school shootings found that approximately 4 out of 5 school attackers shared or leaked their plans beforehand, frequently to their peers. Yet too often those signals go unreported because students are afraid, unsure, or they don't know where to turn. Anonymous reporting systems give students a safe way to speak up without fear, and that is one of the clearest opportunities we have to stop violence before it happens. Third, the bill makes important updates on policies concerning firearms on school property, including requirements for safe storage. And finally, this bill increases investments in student support personnel, and this too is a prevention strategy. Decades of research show that students who are connected to caring adults at school, counselors, social workers, psychologists, are less likely to experience or engage in violence. Gun violence is now the leading cause of death for children in the United States. Preventing it requires sustained, coordinated actions across systems, including our schools. And this bill, as amended, reflects what we know works. We respectfully urge you to support this bill as part of Minnesota's ongoing efforts to protect children and strengthen violence prevention in our schools and our communities. Children should not carry fear to school. They should carry their backpacks. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Fitzsimmons. We will now go to our remote testifier, Sarah Bernhard.
Thank you. Hello, and Chair Youakim, Co-Chair Krisha, Vice Chair Hill, and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Bernhardt. I'm a nationally certified school psychologist and board member of the Minnesota School Psychologists Association, also known as MSPA. I'm testifying here today on behalf of MSPA in support of House File 4893. MSPA thanks this committee for its continued commitment to student safety and well-being. At the heart of this bill for our members is not only getting student support personnel aid into schools faster, but ensuring that funding is sustainable for years to come. By moving the increased allowance into the current biennium and embedding this support in the base budget going forward, you give school districts the fiscal stability required to make permanent hires. Staffing shortages cannot be addressed with one-time or contingent funding. Districts need reliable, sustained revenue before they can commit to the long-term contracts necessary to bring more psychologists, social workers, and counselors into our schools. Progress has been made, but the gap remains significant. According to the most recent data from the National Association of School Psychologists, Minnesota's student-to-school psychologist ratio stands at 1,047 to 1, more than double the recommended ratio of 500 to 1. Adequate staffing means a psychologist is available when a student is struggling most. That access can mean the difference between a child getting help in time and a tragedy that cannot be undone. This is not only a question of ratios and budgets. It is a question of whether our schools have the infrastructure to function safely and respond when students need help most. Stable funding builds that infrastructure. MSPA looks forward to continuing to partner with this committee and all stakeholders in support of our students. We respectfully urge your support for House File 4893, and thank you. And I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Bernhard. We will now go to we'll now go for questions on this bill. House File 4893. Representative Bennett, will you start us off?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to make some comments here. You know, we've heard ideas in Education Finance Committee here. We've heard them in Education Policy Committee. And they've not just been Democrat ideas or Republican ideas. They've been ideas where student safety was the priority. And also recognizing that the solutions need to be realistic and practical. So I want to point out there are components in here, although I see a ton of mandates, that one in particular we focused on in education policy, and that's the anonymous threat reporting system. And in education policy, we worked across the aisle. Matter of fact, the author reached out to me to come upon an agreement to allow for local control to opt in initially, because if something's a good idea, schools are going to do it. If the funding's there, and Sandy Hook Promise has the grant, so the funding's there, schools will do it if it's a good idea. We don't have to tell them all the time what they have to do. They do have brains at the local level, I can guarantee you that. Our local school board members, our teachers, administrators, families, communities. So we heard when that anonymous reporting system bill came forward, Representative Ray Rauer's bill, we had agreement and it was ready to come for a vote, and then suddenly it was a fiscal note by MDE that was the problem. But I don't see that fiscal component in here, so that it's not a problem anymore, evidently. Then it came up that there was, you know, it just wasn't ready because we needed more, I can't remember the exact wording, but more county involvement and local government involvement. But I don't see that in here. Now I just hear that the local control is the problem, and it really confuses me. And I'm going to say again, I've said it on the floor, I've said it in ed policy, and I'll say it here again too. Why can't we come together on the things we agree upon? This bill, the Ray Rauer Nadeau bill, I will call it, is one where we have agreement. We should be passing this because we do need a multi-level approach, and we're not going to come to agreement on all the different layers, but we certainly can on this one, and I bet you there's others in here where we could get very close. So I'm just going to stop there because I think it's sad. I see more mandates, more mandates, more mandates, and less funding, and it really saddens me. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. Chair Joachim?
Thank you, Chair Clark, and thank you, Representative Bennett, for all the work that you've done in ed policy around this, and I think we are really close. But I would have to disagree that if it's a good idea, schools just opt in, because they could now, and they aren't.
And we're getting to the point where sometimes we just have to say, yes, you're going to have to do something about our school safety. And I do know they care about it, and I do understand that it takes time. That's why we talked to the School Safety Center about pushing out the time for the model policy to be ready that the schools would just then have to adopt for their plan. The anonymous threat reporting, there's a free one at the BCA. In fact, the BCA would prefer that we would use that one because we would have that cross communications between districts, because as we've seen in other school shootings, students don't always stay in one place. They might come back, but they might have been somewhere else where those warning signs were there. And it's also why, if you see on, I've got to look at what line it is, that you see that we push it out for the districts to adopt it until August of 2028. So this gives districts time to do this. It also gives us a budget cycle in between. But it is too important not to start that process now. Because frankly, it's been around and it hasn't been opted into.
Thank you. Representative Lawrence.
Thank you, Chair Cardi, Chair Joachim. I appreciate you bringing forth this bill. And kind of feels like it's a little bit of a response to the bill I presented on Tuesday, but I appreciate the fact that it's got a lot of similar factors in it. You brought a lot of similarities and some of the provisions that were presented on Tuesday as well. So thank you for that. Kind of echoes the common ground that Rep. Bennett had just mentioned here, the things that we have similarities and some of the concerns with. One of the biggest concerns I have with the bill that you presented today is that the biggest difference, I think, from what I presented on Tuesday is it leaves out a lot of students, leaves out a lot of kids. And the premise that that I came with on Tuesday is that we need to protect every student in every school. And that's, I'm going to go back to that. I don't think we should leave any kid out in the state of Minnesota. Every student in every school should be offered the same protection and safety that we can provide from our level here at the state. A couple of the differences, I don't have a question, I just have more comment than anything else. The proposal I had on Tuesday had a lot more funding in it in comparison. This has very, very little funding. As we've heard through a lot of testimony over the schools, funding is a key with safety. And I think it needs to be a part of this as we go forward. And so a lot of difference in the funding that was proposed on Tuesday compared to the bill you've just brought forward today. There seems to be no real funding at all. The bill on Tuesday there has a lot more local control, and I know we differ on this a little bit, but a lot more local control. This has many more mandates. And I know Rep. Bennett has kind of said the same thing, but many more mandates. We've heard over the last year how challenging the mandates have been to our schools, university throughout the state of Minnesota. And I think we can come together alongside and work on that and alleviate that. I don't think this safe school bill needs to have any mandates in it, but we can come together and work on it and give those provisions to keep that local control for our schools. The bill on Tuesday seemed to be much more multi-layered. Then this seems a little more one-dimensional. And I think we need to take a bigger approach as we go forward in this. As I said when I presented a bill on Tuesday, I think school plan needs to protect every student in every school. And I think it needs to be a fundamental part that this committee can come forward with, every student in every school. And I feel like what I presented Tuesday was very realistic ideas, also bipartisan support. And so that's why, as I started out, you had mentioned that there's some things here that we definitely agree on. And I think that's what you've done Tuesday, too. So I look forward to continue to work as we get to the end of session here to work through these ideas and come out with a bill that we can put forward as a committee that university supports every student in every school. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Representative Lawrence, and thank you for bringing your bill forward Tuesday. We'd been working on this for a while, waiting to see what happened in other committees. And the funding stream that's moving in public safety, which I've watched about the public safety grants that's come out of the governor's bill, is something that we would like to look at, that those school safety grants that would be available to all schools, tribal, non-public, public, charters are public, would be available, should be through the School Safety Center. It should not be coming out of the K-12 budget. And with all due respect, your bill on Tuesday did not have a lot of new funding. It had funding that has been used over and over again by every committee here, the NLX funding. And then the other funding, according to the own press conference, was, well, we'll have to figure that out in the tails. That funding seems to coincide exactly with the student support personnel aid money that's already in our schools. You just shifted over to hardening our schools.
And part of a multi-layered approach does include those adults in the building, and that money needs to stay with those adults. And we need to grow the capacity our districts have. When it comes to local control, I've already talked about that. This gives time for that to happen. But we're to a point now that we do have to say it has to be done. We have to start this process now. We can't keep waiting. Childhood doesn't have a rewind, and we can't have a whole nother generation being afraid when they go to school.
Thank you. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Joachim, for bringing the bill forward. I do have a question, and then I do have a comment, Madam Chair. So, one of the things that I heard from my school districts when the original student support system was passed with the $40,000 to hire these people was that the requirements to hire these personnel was so limited that they weren't actually able to use it. So my question is, what happens if a school district cannot use that $40,000? What happens to that?
Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mueller, and thank you for the question. When we first started the student support personnel aid, we phased it in. We only had it at like $17.11 per student because we created a pipeline to help get more people into the profession because it's hard to hire people if they're not there. That's why you saw originally that amount was supposed to jump up to $48 a student. From 17 to 48 is a lot more money for districts to use. The $40,000 you're talking about is the minimum, base minimum we put in. So small schools that wouldn't get up to that $40,000 would actually be able to do something with it. So it was either a $40,000 minimum and or your per pupil aid, whichever was greater. That is why it's so important to keep ramping up that time. And then last year, we also put a lot more flexibility in the SSPA with the people at the table that are all part of that grant process. And there may be still some more flexibility we need to do. I know there's been some proposals this year to include behavioral health counselors. So we can keep looking at that. But this is what we have in front of us, and this is the track we need to keep going down.
Madam Chair. Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. All right. So I wanted to, okay. I'm still getting a lot of questions about that because of the fact that that's one of the reasons why we put some of the flexibility into our bill was, and I understand that as we're starting to broaden that out, that's one thing, but some of the requirements for that money was very limiting, which is the reason why we had some of the flexibility in the bill that we had. My comments on this bill are this. It's a little frustrating to listen to some of the things that were said when we continue to use the same scenarios of Red Lake, Annunciation, and yet this bill has no money for Red Lake and Annunciation because this doesn't go to non-public. It doesn't go to tribal schools. None of this money goes to any of those things. It's frustrating to hear that our schools can't be trusted to do the right thing when we already heard yesterday that there are schools who are using the Sandy Hook Promise to do an anonymous threat report system. We're already hearing it. It is happening. And by saying, hey, here's some guidance around how to do it, go ahead and start doing it because that's really important for you to do. And here's a funding stream for you to be able to do that. Here's some resources for you. We are seeing schools taking the accountability to do that because they know it's a good idea. They're hearing it. And we're already seeing it happen. And so I just think that as we look at some of the things, some of the claims that we're hearing, it's just fundamentally untrue. But I would ask one last question. One of the language that I've been hearing several times is if there's any of these crisis plans or safety school plans, I have heard from some of the members of the community in the disability community that they would like to have language that says that any crisis plan or school safety plan needs to include language that would allow those who have disability to be taken into account. Is that something that you'd be willing to add to this bill, Representative or Chair Joachim?
Chair Joachim?
Thank you, Chair Clardy and Representative Mueller. Thank you for bringing that up. I believe that language is being worked on in the Senate. We'd absolutely look at it and include it as this bill moves forward. And with the student support personnel aid, the flexibility that we provided was to let districts roll over the money, to let them use it to hire people that they had already hired, and to be able to move it around. So we have provided that flexibility, but happy to look at some more of that. That funding stream, though, was very specific for a reason. We have a 1 to 750 student ratio for counselors in our schools. That's unacceptable when 1 out of 250 is what the standard practice should be, and other states have that. We were finding that districts just, by the time they got to hiring those folks, they just didn't have the money. That's why we created a whole entire funding stream. So that is important that we keep the integrity of that. And that was what was so disappointing for me in Tuesday's bill, was allowing districts to just move that over to anything they wanted. We can continue to have these conversations around flexibility for student support personnel aid, but I'm not going to decide for that group of folks that came together over years to put that together. They have to be at the table when they decide what that flexibility looks like.
Last follow-up, Madam Chair.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Clardy. Chair Clardy and Chair Joachim, I appreciate that. I can't support this bill today, and I do have one question for nonpartisan. One of the things that was mentioned about our bill was that this funding comes from someplace else and we can't support it because this is not budget neutral. So I wanted to just have a real quick, where's Mr. Strom? Is he around? Or no, there's Salvic, there he is. Okay, sorry, I'm like, is there a person here that can answer? The money that's spent in this bill, is this something that has been accounted for? Is this something that we would have to find in other places? And that would be my last question. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Joachim, would you like to take that one?
I'll just quickly say that, no, it is one-time money that we look at the bottom line in Ways and Means. It's $4.3 million, I think, Mr. Strom. Boy, I almost demoted you there. Mr. Strom can tell us, he can model those numbers. I'll be talking to the Ways and Means Chair. I think out of the one-time money that's out there, education should get a small little piece, and that's what would cover this. It's not the nebulous $45 million, I believe, was in the bill on Tuesday.
Thank you. I'm also going to call on Ms. Beckel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Solveig Beckel, House Fiscal. So the cost of the student support personnel aid provision, increasing the allowance from $30.05 to $34.32 in fiscal year 27 would be $2.972 million in fiscal year 27, and then that cleanup payment cost in fiscal year 28, $330,000.
Thank you, Ms. Beckel. Moving on to Representative Bigberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Joachim, for bringing this. When we came together in February, I think it was February 24th, when Chair Kreisha had the gavel that first time, the first thing we talked about was school safety. And I think if we just level set a little bit, everyone in this room, everyone across the state agrees that kids need to be safe. The testifier that talked about coming, that kids shouldn't be carrying fear in their backpack, we all agree to that. We 100% agree to that. So I want to say thank you to Chair Kreisha for making it a priority from the get-go, from the committee, right off the bat. On Tuesday, we had ideas that came from both Republicans and Democrats. They were bipartisan ideas in Representative Lawrence's bill to provide options to protect every single kid in every single school. This bill doesn't do that. The bill in front of us doesn't do that. The ideas were realistic, they were practical, and they were able to be put in place and they were executable. Very simple. A key portion of that bill that's missing from this bill is $52 million. We just heard Ms. Beckel say this is about $3.5 million. That's a significant difference in funding. Okay, and it's an increase in Safe Schools revenue, mental health. And I'm interested in this conversation about funding and where to go. We could very easily reprioritize within the education budget. We could reprioritize with one-time funds. You know, and I've talked about this before. There was $100 million left over in the housing fund. Just today, I was told that there's $66 million in the housing account that's interest. $66 million. That funds Representative Lawrence Bill right there. There's $70 million in debt service in the state office building. We have a billion-dollar state office building. Now, we're not going to change that. That's done. We could talk about SGOs and get creative. We could reprioritize some of MDE's budget. We could do this. We can prioritize. So all of this funding conversation is a distraction, in my opinion, because we unanimously, out of this committee, passed a bill that is getting rid of a $250 million cut to special ed, which we all agree is a terrible idea to do that. So that's going to go to, that's at Ways. We're going to hear the governor's proposal in just a little bit. His idea for safe schools is to cut $50 million more to special ed. We have an $80 million cut coming to compensatory that we were told, don't worry, Universal Meals is going to take care of that. But heaven forbid we reprioritize Universal Meals dollars to take care of the compensatory cut that came from that bill. We can reprioritize things if we want to. More mandates and less money is not a plan. It is a continual pushing of burdens onto our schools that they cannot carry. And I'm going to end with this. Chair Joachim, you said that we have to do this. We have to mandate this anonymous threat reporting. And I agree that this should be happening, by the way. The plants should be happening. Totally agree. But if I wrote down your quote, you said, frankly, we can't make it an option now because they're not doing it now. And I think that just highlights the fundamental difference in understanding that educators across the state are so sick and tired of hearing from legislators. Okay, I've been an educator for 25 years. Honestly, it wasn't until I got to the legislature this year that I truly understood anonymous threat reporting. If schools understood this, they would do it like this. We don't need to mandate good ideas. And it gets down to this fundamental truth. Do we trust our schools to do what's best for their community, for their kids? Do we do that? Representative Lawrence Bill did that. It said, here's some funding. It's not enough. We could reprioritize. But do we trust our schools enough? So right now, Chair Joachim, thank you for bringing this. I can't support this, even though there's provisions within this proposal that would be good, but we have a lot of work we need to do to get there, and I look forward to partnering with whoever wants to work to keep our kids safe.
Thank you. Chair Clardy, Representative Bakeberg. I'll wait for the closing for most of my comments, but I just have to say a few things right now. When you talk about reprioritizing on universal meals and taking money out of housing, we're talking about fundamental needs in Maslow's hierarchy that, unfortunately, you're right, our schools have to meet sometimes because sometimes their families can't. And it's really hard for a kid to learn in school when they haven't eaten the night before. And it's really hard for them to learn when they don't know where they're sleeping that night. So universal meals was one of those things that was finally like, aha, people get it. Kids don't come to school like little automatons that can just sit in a desk. They bring things with them in that backpack. And sometimes we have to meet those needs. So I'm sorry, I won't sit up here and take food away from kids and housing away from kids to harden schools when we know that is not the only way to do this. And we do work with our other committees. Public Safety has a bill before them to put money into the School Safety Center for grants for all of our schools. I'm talking about our K through 12 budget and what we can do for those kids when they're there. And I know you think I don't understand school safety, but I have been a para in schools since I've been a legislator. I am married to a career teacher who's been there for 35 years. I have a son that's fourth generation teacher on both sides of the family. I have four sister-in-laws who teach and a daughter-in-law who teaches. And every time I hear about a school shooting, I think about each and every one of them knowing that they dive in front of that bullet to save their children. I know how hard our teachers work. And I want to be partners with them, and I know we all want to be partners with them too. And we may have our differences of opinions about here, but we are so close to doing something this year on this. My hope is that we stop just lobbing things at each other and actually sit down and talk. And today is our last committee meeting, but that doesn't mean that this isn't over, and that doesn't mean work can still happen. Thank you.
Thank you. Moving to Chair Ray, Representative Ray Ryan.
Yeah, thank you so much, Madam Chair. I mean, you can, you know. So I just want to address the language in the bill that is from my anonymous threat reporting system again after we had some comments connected to it. So as you know, all of you other legislators at the table know, when you actually do get a bill hearing, because you don't get them on most of your bills, so when you actually get a bill hearing, suddenly you start to hear from a lot of advocates and a lot of different groups of people. And that's what happened to me. So I started to have meetings and hear from all types of different groups that had interest in this anonymous threat reporting system language. It was mentioned that there was something about counties or local something that didn't agree. I'm not aware of that, so that didn't come from me. But I do acknowledge that I did hear from MDE concerns about absorbing the cost. So that was one thing that was a concern that was raised. But as I continued to have more of these discussions with advocates and stakeholders, it became really clear that we need every district to utilize an anonymous threat reporting system. And that is why I pulled the bill at that time as chief author. So I'm not going to get into what happened next, you know, some political stuff. But rather, I would like to just reaffirm that this isn't the end today. We actually do still have the ability to come to the table and make a compromise between each other and get some work done this year. So I just call on all of us to be willing to do that and to put our kids first and come and get a bill package passed. And so I do also want to share that if a school district did decide to utilize the Department of Public Safety's statewide anonymous threat reporting system, what the district has to do simply is provide to students and families and employees and committee members information about the system, how to use the system, put that information on its website and in its handbook, and notify parents. So we're talking about some emails and a website update and including it in a bulletin. So these are not like beyond capacity when you think about what it can do, which is to save our students' lives. So thank you. Thank you again for the bill.
Thank you, Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair Clardy. Thank you for bringing the bill, Chair Joachim. And you know, as we go through today's bill and look back on Representative Lawrence's bill on Tuesday, there are similarities, there are departures. And I'll reiterate what I said on Tuesday, that you know, the more hands on deck that can be utilized through increased student support, personnel funding, the better. You know, we want our students to be known, we want them to be cared for, and we want them to feel comfortable at school, in school. To me, keeping guns out of our schools is paramount to keeping our students safe, and I think anyone would be hard-pressed to decline that or
to argue against it. And the role I fulfilled as our EA president allowed me to stand in every classroom in the district where I teach several times and see the magic that was happening there. And as I think about today's debate, I kind of walk through the district in my mind's eye, and I wonder, you know, are there folks out there that believe that we need more guns in our early childhood centers? Do we need any guns in our early childhood centers? Do we need more guns in our elementary schools? Do we need any guns in our elementary schools? Our middle schools or high school where we have school resource officers? And the answer for me is a clear no. All of the above questions. These weapons have no place in our schools, and it's our duty to keep our students safe. It's our duty to keep our students comfortable and cared for in our schools. And I can't imagine anybody that would disagree with that. And so I think the question comes, why would you oppose a measure like this if you care about student safety? If you do, I wonder about what other allegiances would lead you to oppose it. And so I'm going to vote yes on this bill. I support it. I think it's a good bill to keep our students safe. And as we move forward, that's our goal with this legislation. And it's a noble goal. And it's one that I look forward to working on as we move through this session and every other session that I'm present here at the Capitol. I would, Chair, request a roll call, please.
Thank you. Representative Lee. And there will be a roll call.
Thank you, Chair. And I appreciate the request for a roll call. I think it's really important for us to be on the record that we support our students. I want to thank Chair Joachim for putting together this proposal that, you know, creatively finds a way to increase the student support personnel aid. It's clear from meetings with our students and from the testifiers, you know, even on Tuesday, that addressing mental health and chemical dependency is a really real issue for our students. This year, I've met with students from across St. Paul and in other cities who tell me about how young their peers and or siblings are starting to turn to substances because they lack support in other areas. And, you know, in this new modern world, there are so many more substances that have been created that, you know, are meant to be addictive. And so the younger you start, the more addictive you are, because that makes you a customer for life. So I appreciate the way that, you know, this creatively uses one-time funding. And another piece of the bill before I close that I want to cover is just this, what boggles my mind about the anonymous threat reporting is, you know, if school districts are already doing this, I don't really understand why it is a problem that we're mandating this. And so, you know, I want to leave those comments about the contents of the bill. But more importantly, for parents maybe watching or people who don't normally follow the legislature, you know, today is the last day of our committee. Tomorrow is their deadline. That means, you know, we're done hearing bills about committees. And if we haven't passed out a bill, then, you know, really don't have anything to show for. And so, you know, I just want folks to understand that there are two things that, you know, should have happened in this session, right? This conversation that we're having in the last week of a session should have been started earlier. And we also should have passed a budget resolution so that, you know, our committee has a path forward. I don't want folks leaving this hearing thinking that there's just random money lying around that this committee could repurpose. That's not how the legislature works. At least, you know, that's how I was taught. And so I know many of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle also know that leadership has to agree to targets so that committees have a roadmap. And so we know what we can spend. Our speaker has not done that. When leadership fails, this is what happens. You know, we lodge complaints against each other and we don't finish our work. So I want us to be able to find a resolution before May 17th, but this means we have to be clear-eyed about what that work looks ahead. And, you know, that starts with this, right? We heard a lot of agreement today, and I understand, you know, Chair Joachim has tried very hard to figure out, you know, how we'll find money to finance this. So I will vote yes, and I hope other people do too.
Chair Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Thank you, Chair Youakim, for the bill and the discussion. So first thing I have to take issue with, the statement of the speaker not coming to, that's categorically false. I'm on Ways and Means. The Ways and Means chairs from both parties have not come to that agreement. So let's put the conversation where the conversation's at. So as we look at this, I was going to invite the school groups up and say which one of you wants to come up and support more mandates, but I'm not going to do that. We all go by the conversations we have. We're not here for motives. We're not here for what we think each other's doing. We go by the conversations we have to get us to this point. I have not had one single school ask for more mandates. Okay. So why am I against mandates personally? I have lots of great ideas, and I think schools should take those ideas. But it's not my role to tell anybody to do my ideas. We had a referendum that failed in my own district. That is the choice of the constituents. That is the choice of the people that live there. Okay? Whether I trust or don't trust somebody doesn't enter into my purview. It's I have to respect that schools are making the decisions based on their own constituents and their own people and their own students. Okay? So whether or not I think someone should opt in or opt out of it, I don't get that call. And what we're seeing here is forcing more schools into these positions, and they may be great ideas, they may be terrible ideas. But the fact of the matter is because we force schools into those positions, and again, no school groups have come up here and said, please give us more mandates or please don't, they are forced dealing with the constraints they have, which has caused fund imbalances across the board for them. They have money in their own districts that they cannot use, they can't move because of the restrictive nature of our accounts. We're just a spreadsheet committee. That's all we are. And we're trying to put things in places where schools can have access to that, and that's what this is. The bill we saw on Tuesday actually put some money out there because we can try to find that, but in absence of the targets by Ways and Means, we had to put a stake in the ground. There is money to be found. But we have to put that out there rather than just the proverbial dot, 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 which doesn't work. School support. It's a very solid idea, and we should add more money to that, and we should expand the uses for that. That has positive outcomes. And we should allow schools to take that to the step next best for them and not us just constraining them to what we think those advantages are. Members, the no for me on this is we haven't gone far enough. We have to make sure the non-public schools are part of this equation. We just can't talk about them and over their head. We have to talk to them. They are a big part of this equation, not because of the school they go to, but because, for goodness sakes, they're human beings and kids. It's that simple. And so leaving that class of student out, the governor has done it. The governor continues to poke them and say, I'll talk about them and use them when I need them, but I won't talk to them. He's done that in his budget. He wants to cut right to the non-public. Cutting to the special ed is cutting kids. And so for that, members, the struggle is real in our schools. Mandates, when we tell them how to use the money instead of giving them the flexibility and allowing them to go to what works for them, we take away their tools. So, members, I can't support this bill where it is. I hope the conversations continue to move forward, and I hope they will. We know how this happens. I was going to say before, Chair Youakim is my loyal opposition, but Cheryl is my colleague. And I know how to differentiate those two. If we get to a point where our two leadership can start to talk to us and say, hey, get this done, get to this position, we'll come up with a House position, and then we'll go fight the Senate, which is the other battle. So for those reasons, members, I'll be a no on this bill.
Thank you. Chair Youakim, any final words on your bill?
Thank you, and thank you, Co-Chair Carisha. I know if we sat in a room for a day, we could get this done, and I look forward to that. And, you know, it really is not too late for our community to come together and pass a multi-layered approach to school safety, and this is a 3D layered approach. You have before you something that can be done now that's efficient, effective, and can pass this session. It increases funds for licensed personnel, trained in crisis intervention and mental health supports in the school, one layer. It requires school safety plans and anonymous threat reporting systems with time for our schools to implement them, another layer. And it requires safe storage of guns on school grounds because we cannot have this conversation without talking about guns, third layer. It's a common sense bill that takes an evidence-based approach. I would ask for your support because it's time to come to the table. Thank you.
Thank you. So Chair Youakim renews their motion that House File 4893 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, and the clerk will now take roll.
Chair Youakim.
Yes.
Co-Chair Kreshaw.
No.
Co-Vice Chair Bakeberg.
No.
Co-Vice Chair Clardy.
Yes.
Representative Altendorf.
No.
Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Representative Bennett.
No.
Representative DePell.
No.
Representative Gander.
No.
Representative Gordon.
No.
Representative Green.
Aye.
Representative Hill.
Hill votes yes.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Knudsen.
No.
Representative Lawrence.
Lawrence votes no.
Representative Lee.
Yes.
Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes no.
Representative Perez-Vega.
Perez-Vega, yes.
Representative Quam.
No.
Representative Ream.
Ream, yes.
Representative Rebrower.
Rebrower, yes.
Representative Reimer.
No.
Representative Sensor Mira.
Aye.
Representative Vernick.
Yes.
With there not being the necessary 13 votes to move the bill out of committee, the motion fails. I'll hand the gavel back to Chair Youakim.
Peppers. All right, I'd like to call. Unfortunately, I think we timed out the governor's staff, but I want to make sure that the commissioner has a chance to speak. And Mr. Uni and Commissioner, I am sorry to pull everybody here. Maybe you can all stay after to answer questions. But it is so nice to see you in committee once again. Commissioner, once you get settled, could you please state your name for the record and proceed?
Good afternoon, Chair Youakim and committee members. My name is Willie Jett. I have the privilege of serving as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you for the opportunity to offer some brief remarks on the Governor's 2026 Education Budget Bill. This bill includes provisions that support safe, inclusive learning environments where students have access to proactive, research-based supports. It prioritizes student safety by equipping educators and school staff to recognize signs of mental health distress and respond with trauma-informed, research-based care. The agency will support this student support intervention resource framework with statewide expertise and technical assistance. As part of the governor's focus on program integrity and fraud prevention, including the proposed statewide Office of Inspector General, the bill includes changes to MDE's Office of Inspector General. We appreciate the legislature's partnership and look forward to continuing this work to ensure that staff have the tools needed to prevent fraud and strengthen program integrity. The bill also convenes a task force to revisit the state's approach to student assessments with the goal of providing a more comprehensive, timely, and instructional, useful picture of student learning while reducing the pressure from high-stakes testing. Paraprofessionals are valued educators who often lack adequate support. A new paraprofessional position will serve as a statewide point of contact and help build a more coherent system of support to strengthen, practice, and improve student outcomes. The bill includes technical and best practice updates across programs such as the attendance pilot, Compass, the READ Act, full-service community schools, and graduation incentives to ensure effective implementation and full use of available funding. It also includes provisions related to the recent federal voucher program. If a future administration opts in, the proposal would shift those funds to the state's voluntary pre-kindergarten program to help ensure early learner success. And finally, I want to address changes to the Blue Ribbon Commission. The February forecast shows a continued structural imbalance in future years. To help maintain a balanced budget, the governor proposes an additional $50 million reduction. This serves as a starting point to underscore the importance of long-term fiscal balance. And we're committed to partnering with the legislature and engaging in thoughtful discussions to achieve that goal. And so I just want to say, end by saying thank you, Chair Joaquim, for your time. We look forward to continuing our work with the legislature to achieve our shared goal of being the education state. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I once again apologize for having timed out on with our school safety discussion. And members, if you haven't seen the presentation, I watched it when they presented in front of the Senate. I suggest that you do. A lot of those folks that have signed up to testify here testified there. To those who have signed up to testify and aren't able to make it, weren't able to testify today, please feel free to send in your written comments and we'll post them on the committee page. And with that, Commissioner, was there anything else that you wanted to add? Thank you. Co-Chair Kreisha, any final comments on your last committee?
Oh, yes, lots.
Well, I'll see you in Ways and Means, yes. But your last committee that you're co-chair of.
Yeah, so Commissioner Jett, have a lot of respect for what you've done in the schools and you being here. I see you there. We have a new coach for the Gopher Hockeys next year, so we'll have a different cheer. Now, you are sitting here with a budget that the governor put together in front of you, which is an awful, awful idea. If there's a school out there that supports this, I can't believe they're not doing anything but cringing right now. And so I'll just leave it here. I know we're short of time. You've heard lots of comments. The interesting thing is the additional $50 million cuts and the other ideas, and not including the non-public and the way that's addressed, is just simply really bad policy and I think a bad approach. And I think the governor understands that, which is why he's almost going to this position. But what I would add on that, because I know the governor listens to me, because when I said I wasn't going to help him on his budget, and by God, I'm not going to help him pass another $50 million cut, and his response was to send us home, and I made a motion for us to go home. So I have responded every single time to the governor. So if he wants to get serious and pull this back and find an actual budget and talk about how we can get some more fundings away, school trust is out there. We have some school safety, some things. I'm happy to do that. But this budget is just not workable.
Thank you, Co-Chair Kreisha. With that, Commissioner and all the folks at MDE, thank you for being a resource and always answering our questions when we call. And thank you for your partnership. I know there are a few good things in here, and we don't know what the rest of the session is going to hold, but know that we have an open door as well. And members, we just want to thank you for the time and attention you've put into this committee. Education finance is complicated and can be also very emotional because we're talking about our kids. So thank you all for your time. And with that, 20 more seconds. Co-Chair Kreisha.
Yes. So, members, we're not going to talk about our next meeting. But I do, I think we should all acknowledge also Chair Joaquim, who's been around in other areas and been a resource, property tax chair, ed policy chair, and also education finance. And that comes with a lot of respect and institutional knowledge, and as well, I absolutely want to reciprocate. I was serious when I said Chair Joaquim is my loyal opposition, but Cheryl is my colleague.
Thank you, Co-Chair Kreisha. And that, I'm going to end on that positive note. And with that, members, we are adjourned.